if you walk in the middle, if you say, oh, peace for everybody, if you don't take a side, no one respects you. No one has ever said, oh my God, I love that person. They never pick a side. Oh my God, I really respect that person. They have no courage. You can't have people obsessed with you without having people who hate you. When you stand firmly in your core values and you come from a place of love, you will not be canceled. You will be celebrated. So dig into your core values. When you know you're on the right side of history, don't apologize for it. You will be rewarded for it. You just got to keep going, and you will pull in your tribe. You will pull in people into your life who you appreciate and who appreciate you for the true you, not the person you're pretending to be. And I will tell you, that is the antidote to burnout, and it is the antidote to leading a purposeful life beyond yourself.
This is a Jewish TV channel presentation. Welcome to Talking Point, where controversial subjects are brought into sharp focus. Conversations with JTVC show host Laura Kessler comes up next.
Welcome to Talking Point. I'm Laura Kessler. Dr. Sheila Nazarian is a Persian Jew who escaped from Iran and has, by all accounts, lived the American dream. She's a top board certified plastic surgeon in Beverly Hills, founder of the Skin Spot, a collection of medical grade skincare and wellness products. She starred in the Emmy nominated Netflix series Skin Decision. She's appeared on E! News, Newsweek, The Doctors, PragerU, Inside Edition, and too many news media outlets to mention. And in the world of Jewish advocacy, she's considered a top influencer with a social media following of nearly 2 million. And has achieved unique crossover success, being both a Persian Jew and someone living in Los Angeles. She gets away with stuff the rest of us don't, and we'll analyze that too. Dr. Nazarian also teaches at the University of Southern California and inspires other entrepreneurs through the Nazarian Institute, a conference to help other entrepreneurs to think big, branding, innovation, and growth. She's a true Renaissance woman. Much like our friends from the former Soviet Union, her antennas were sharply picking up warning signals long before the majority of American Ashkenazi Jews woke up on October 7th. She's also been vocal about what Mizrahi Jews can teach American Ashkenazi Jews, and we're really excited to get her insights today. Welcome, Sheila. It's so great to have you with us.
Thank you so much. That was such a great intro. I'm exhausted listening to it. So much done.
Well, you've done a lot in your life. I want to start, we're going to get right into it, but first, can you tell our audience just a little bit about your background as an immigrant? And you have some really interesting stuff, and I want them to know your story and how you've got to be here, because you're really a self-made person, and that's inspiring in a lot of ways.
No, absolutely. So I was born in Long Island on vacation. My mom wanted me to be a U.S. citizen, and so when she was 9 months pregnant, she came to the U.S., so I would be born here. That was 1979, the year of the revolution, but right before it started, or it got really bad, they went back to Iran, because, you know, our lives were there. Shortly thereafter, the Iran-Iraq war started. They wouldn't let Jews leave. There was bombs coming in and sirens going off, very similar to what we see on TV happening in Israel, and they realized very quickly kind of where Iran was going. They had two daughters and realized, you know, this probably isn't a good place for our daughters. My father was the CMO of the Shah's Heart Hospital, and he had a laboratory technician who was part of the revolution. And he came to my father one day, and my father had saved this gentleman's eyesight by diagnosing him early. And so he came to my father and he said, you saved my eyes. I'm going to save your life. You're on the list. You have to leave. So
wow.
My father left the passport of me, my mom, and my sister with the government and said he was going on a medical conference. And he flew to Vienna and waited there for us and kind of worked to get us visas. One day my mom took me and my sister to the bazaar, and we got in the back of a covered truck, laying in the fetal position, kind of puzzle pieces with strangers that were also getting smuggled. They took us close to the Pakistani border, and we, you know, switched out into pickup trucks and had a little rest stop at a bathroom, which was basically like a clay hut with a hole in the ground. And that's where my mom told me that we were going to America. And I immediately thought I was going to meet Michael Jackson because we had so many bootleg videos of him in Iran. So we spent one night in the desert, and around 2 to 3 a.m. in the morning, the border police spotted us and began to shoot at us. And so we got in the back of the trucks, turned on the headlights at that point because we'd already been discovered. And the smugglers took us through a roller coaster through the desert, as my mom had told me we were about to go on. And it's really interesting. You know, a year ago I was in Dubai and we took one of those tours into the desert, and it brought back the memory of how we drove through the desert. I had forgotten. Yeah, it was so just like a core memory was revived. It was insane. So anyways, we got away from the smugglers because we went over a ravine and it was too dangerous for them to follow us. We then spent 3 months in Pakistan waiting for visas to go reunite with my father in Vienna. And that was the first time I personally experienced anti-Semitism. We would go down into the lobby of the hotel and watch weddings happen in the hotel. And an adult woman came up to me, and at that time I was 6.5, 7 years old. And she asked me if I was Jewish, and I said yes, and she spit right in my face. Then after 3 months, we were able to get visas, and we got off the train, I remember, and my father had shaved his beard, so I didn't recognize him. And then he began to speak, and then I recognized him, the core memory there as well. We spent 3 months in Vienna waiting for visas to legally immigrate to the U.S., and eventually we did. We lived with my aunt in a two-bedroom apartment, 8 of us, until my father was able to pass his boards and start to work. And I remember he used to take his bicycle to the public library every day to study and, you know, start a new life in America.
Amazing. You must have probably so much to say about our current border, everything. I know a lot of people from countries that escaped communism and socialism are really being triggered now, and we should really do a whole episode on just that sometime. But I find perspectives from people like yourself, Mizrahi Jews, and Jews from the former Soviet Union are just so spot on. It's just like a...
Well, you know, I think it's an interesting point to make on that. And I'll just sum up our future episode in, you know, a little 1-minute statement. I think that the Jews that have escaped socialism and communism, like the Russian Jews, like the Middle Eastern Jews, like South American Jews, our trauma and the lens through which we see the world and the murders and the injustices, we associate that with the language of the left, especially now. You know, you said it in your introduction, the Persian Jews, we've been smelling the same smells and hearing the same sounds as we did here, as we did in pre-revolutionary Iran. And so that's why I was one of the first to start ringing the alarm and saying, you guys pay attention. You know, all of these injustices were cloaked in altruistic words. They used to say, why is the Shah living in a castle when there's homeless people on the street? Just like they are now. Words that you can get behind, like diversity, like inclusion. You know, all of these things that happen in Iran, that you see the women who have lost their freedom, the men who have lost their freedoms, they were all cloaked in really altruistic words. You know, words that sounded like justice and fairness. Yeah. And, you know, so that's the lens through which we see the world. So we can't politically understand how anyone can support that. Whereas the Ashkenazi Jews, you know, their trauma comes from the Holocaust and nationalism and words that they associate with the right politically, which I think, you know, the political parties have shifted so much. I don't think they're the same as, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, obviously, quite different.
Yeah,
but so, you know, the Ashkenazi Jews in America who predominantly vote, you know, left, it's because of their trauma and the lens through which they see the world. But I think at this point, and we'll get into this, it's time to make a real evaluation of maybe you've thought some way in the past, but maybe it's time to think again. Maybe it's time to reevaluate And so that's what I'm really trying to do through my social media as a Persian Jew, as someone who has suffered from socialism and communism and Islamic extremism, to bring that lens and that vision and that clarity to Ashkenazi Jews and beyond. You know, I was just in Great Neck, which is predominantly, you know, Persian Jews, and I gave a talk. And the Ashkenazi rabbi, when we, you know, they were saying, well, we need peace. How do we get to peace? And I said, you know, peace is like a ceasefire. It goes both ways. Both people have to be wanting peace. You cannot make peace with a majority that is radicalized. You have to spend time, denazify, de-radicalize the people so that they see that there's more to life than martyrdom. And he said, no, that's racist. And I said, it's not racist. It's fact. And so even after October 7th, people are still not willing to listen to the lived experience of the Persian Jews and what we've been through, having lived in a land dominated by political Islam and Islamic extremism. I mean, that's the state we're in right now. It's the frustration that we are feeling right now, and I'm sure we'll get into it further.
You know, you raised so many good points there, and I really like the piece about trauma, because we've been talking a lot about trauma on my show, but before this series, I did the Jewish mental health and trauma series. Mm-hmm. And I like how you're differentiating Ashkenazi trauma from the Holocaust being more triggered by the right wing, whereas for Mizrahi and Sephardic, you know, it's more triggered by the left. And that's fascinating. And the Russian Jews as well.
And I just want to say, too, I want people to reevaluate this question. Who is more dangerous right now? The Ku Klux Klan, who is completely underfunded and in 2019 only had 5,000 members, or the Squad, who is well-funded by the Socialist Democrats of America, who is passing legislation? You know, who is more powerful? Who is more scary right now? Who needs to be stopped? Who is a priority? So it's really time for the Ashkenazim to reevaluate the real threat. Now is the time.
I think for everybody, you know, and I think when we get into your proposed solution for this, it's an incidence of really psychographics versus demographics. And as a doctor, you appreciate you have to diagnose the problem right. And
this is where
DEI goes wrong is, you know, I don't think everybody who does things has the right intentions, but I do think a lot of them are and are just dragged down. And when they get educated, a lot of them change. Like I had Ron Hafner on, and, you know, he's a professor that was living in his office. And, you know, he showed his students, he's like, just literally just showed them a map. They're like, oh, you mean like there's nothing in between then anymore? It's like, no, it changed a lot of people's minds. But it's like, there are so many of them saying misinformation,
right?
And there's so few of us. And even of us, how many of us are really activists? How many of us are effective activists? There's so much
right
there. So just transitioning there, you went to medical school. I think you got a business degree also. And then give us a little bit on how you transitioned to an activist. And then we're going to dive in deep to DEI and your detail system.
Absolutely. So, you know, I'm 44 years old now. I have a 16-year-old, a 15-year-old, and a 12-year-old that I had during residency. And my 16-year-old, about a few years ago, was applying to my high school. And I already knew the stats of how many Jewish college students were hiding their identity at that time, 3-4 years ago. And I said, mm-hmm. You know what, if I don't start speaking up about my Judaism, because of the Netflix show, it's in almost every country in the world. And I was speaking to Outside the Echo Chamber. And, you know, if I don't speak up to people who maybe have never even met a Jew before in their life, how will her college experience be when she gets there? Is she going to be hiding her identity? Is she going to be walking on eggshells and afraid to speak up? I mean, the best memories I have from college, and I went to Columbia, by the way, the best memories I had were talking to people at 2 a.m. in the hallways who don't look like me, didn't grow up like me, don't believe what I believe. I mean, that was the best part of college. I barely remember learning anything new, to be honest with you, because my high school was so competitive. I went in with 22 AP credits, so, and I was pre-med. I've already taken all those classes, you know? So the things I remember about college, and when they say college is the best years of your life, were these experiences with classmates and with people who grew up differently than me. So if I don't start speaking up, is my daughter going to go and have a, you know, free speech score of 0 at Harvard? You know, what's the point of college at that point? So I said, you know what, I'm going to start just exposing to my followers that I'm Jewish. So with great trepidation, freaking out, I wrote one Friday, hashtag Shabbat Shalom. And, you know, in Iran, you never said you were Jewish. You would change your last name to not sound Jewish. And I was freaking out when I did it, but it kind of went okay. And I was like, okay, well, that went okay. So then they asked me to speak in front of the federal building in Los Angeles because California was trying to take Holocaust education out of the public school systems in their ethnic studies program. So I told my husband, I'm going to go speak in front of the federal building. He's like, are you crazy? Is there security there? Is the FBI going to be there? I mean, totally freaking out because, again, we're all first-generation Persian Jews that, you know, left a country where you never said you were Jewish. So I basically went in front of the federal building, and my husband swooped me away right after I gave the talk, and kind of that went okay. So I was like, okay, well, that went okay. So it was very much a process of, like, you know, little by little, seeing how things went, maybe pushing myself 10% out of my comfort zone, and and living there for a moment until that became comfortable, and then maybe pushing myself 10% more in the courage category. Then the May 2021 conflict happened, and I was seeing my colleagues, medical colleagues, posting the same 5 propaganda words: genocide, apartheid, colonialism, you know, all this stuff. And so they had about 100,000 followers, and I think at that time I had about 500,000 followers. And I said, you know what, I have more followers than you, watch me go. And my page on Instagram literally went from boobs and Botox to Israel, 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 and fighting for the Jewish people. And I lost 3,000 followers in the first 30 minutes of my first post. But I just kept going because I said, you know what, if I don't start speaking up for my kids, I'm not gonna be able to sleep well at night. It's not worth it to me to have all these followers and not be able to talk about what I think is important. You know, my parents didn't leave everything they had in Iran for me to come to America and be afraid to speak. I mean, that's not why they did it.
Yeah, good for you, because so many people, because of that generational trauma response, might be the opposite, and they might be smaller and say, oh, let's be invisible, let's have no profile, no mezuzah. And I love that you took that generational trauma and you've reversed it. And you're being a role model.
Which is a great point. Which is a great point. And, you know, it was really scary. I have to tell you, it was the first time in my life that I have had anxiety. The first time. And I've, you know, my mother passed away from cancer when I was 16. I escaped from Iran under gunfire. And this was the first time in my life that I had anxiety. So I want to tell you, it wasn't like I was born this way. I'm a Persian Jewish girl. You know, I wanted to have everyone like me and pat me on the head and tell me what an excellent person I am. But, you know, at a certain point, things are too important. I was honestly in survival mode. I was like, if I don't stand up for the Jewish people, what happened to us in Iran is going to happen to us again. And I'm not going to let America go down because America's given me so much. And it's so important to me, and I love this country so much. I'm not going to let this country go down. And so that's why I literally risked everything. I have to tell you, I thought I was going to be out of a job. I thought that I was going to not have any patients. I thought all my employees were going to walk out. This was not something that I just did, and I was like, oh, everything's going to be okay. And I had heard a statement in the past that basically said that up until the age of 40, you need to have an ego in order to be successful. You know, you have to have that something pushing you in order to be successful. And after the age of 40, it's about letting go of your ego and giving back and paying it forward once you've achieved that success.
Ooh, wow.
So I said, you know what? I'm going to look at my Instagram the same way. I'm going to lose all my followers. I'm going to give back. And that's just what we're going to do. But you know what I have to tell you, and I want to tell the people listening to this, the exact opposite thing happened. And I learned so much, and I'd like to pass on that learning to your listeners. I realize that if you walk in the middle, if you say, oh, peace for everybody, if you don't take a side, no one respects you. No one has ever said, oh my God, I love that person. They never pick a side. Oh my God, I really respect that person. They have no courage. Oh, I really love this person. I'm obsessed with this person. They just walk on eggshells everywhere they go. That's not how it works. So what happened is my patients, I would see them in the office, they were crying. I loved you before. I'm obsessed with you now. My employees are so proud to work there because they know that they're contributing to this mission. I've had people fly in from all over the world to have surgery with me because they said, I like the way you think. I want to support you. So that was one thing. You can't have people obsessed with you without having people who hate you. That was learning number one. And learning number two is when you stand firmly in your core values and you come from a place of love, you will not be canceled. You will be celebrated. God rewards the authentic. So dig into your core values. When you know you're on the right side of history, don't apologize for it. You will be rewarded for it. You just got to keep going, and you will pull in your tribe. You will pull in people into your life who you appreciate and who appreciate you for the true you, not the person you're pretending to be. And I will tell you, that is the antidote to burnout, and it is the antidote to leading a purposeful life beyond yourself. So I would do it again 100 times over, and I wanted to share that with your audience.
I love that. I love that, and I love how you're talking about the core values, because that is so important for everybody, but especially for a doctor. As we've been talking about, we've lost our way on so many levels in politics, in medicine, in the legal system, where we have strayed from our core values. And I've done a lot of shows about the loss of Jewish identity, especially here in America and the diaspora. And I know that's a real concern. And Israel, too. You know, that's the whole thing Jewish TV channel stands for, is fighting the AIM syndrome, anti-Semitism, Israelphobia, and miseducation. The greatest miseducation, unfortunately, has been within. And it's hard to raise strong children to withstand these kinds of pressures, which is completely unlike anything I went through growing up in the 80s, and you know, and it's just like they need that identity piece. And
but I have to tell you too, look at the college students right now who are standing up in front of Congress. What is the predominant theme you see? What is it that you see? They are Persian Jewish girls.
Yep.
Literally, go back. Five of them that are in front of Congress giving testimony are Persian Jewish girls. Why? Because they have strong Persian Jewish moms who taught them, because we live this. We are first generation. We have not forgotten what anti-Semitism is. We have raised our families and we have raised our children to be strong and to speak up against this, because it is so fresh in our minds. We've only been in America for 40 years. So you're right. It is a failure among parents who did not teach their kids to be strong in their core values. It is a failure in Jewish parents who did not sit across the Shabbat table with their families and tell them who they are and where they come from and teach them their culture. So it's time for people to wake up on that end too and start showing the kids our culture, giving them roots so when the wind blows, their tree does not sway.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. I want to just, like, on the other side, you know, a lot of this was institutional. I did a show with Nialek back in early January of last year, The Miseducation of American Jewry. Some of this was the corporate. It was, you know, we moved from a shtetl in the old world to a corporate model, and this sort of McDonaldization of Hebrew school and Sunday school.
You're right.
That was not run.
And no one
it
knows it better than Maya, because she's Russian.
The thing is, like, you know, it wasn't the rabbi running everything. Like, my dad grew up in a very close-knit Ashkenazi community, and he got his identity. He transmitted it to me. But you know, the rabbi was the cantor, he was the basketball coach, he taught Hebrew, so he was like, you know, wearing every hat. And then yes. they compartmentalized it into, you know, the JCC on one side where you have the fun, and then the book learning at the synagogue, and that's optional. That was the moment where it went wrong, in my opinion.
You're right.
You know, we've done a lot of shows on that. My impression of people, because I have friends on the left, I have friends on the right, and the friends on the left are really hurting right now. They're really devastated. And I resist the urge to say, I told you so.
It's not I told you so. Honestly, for me, it's not I told you so. It's why didn't you listen?
Here's how I frame it. I frame it like, well, we've told people for years and years and years, and they didn't listen. Maybe they'll at least listen to us now as we're shouting it so that we stop the spread into K-12 with these ethnic studies curriculums and the academic boycotts that they're trying to do. You know, it's just sort of like, well, do the right thing now. I'm not gonna beat them over the head endlessly for the past. I'm gonna transmit it into something actionable.
Well, I mean, we have no other choice, do we? There's no other choice.
Yeah.
I mean, we have to do it what you just said.
And it all goes down to DEI. You know, I used to be one of those people that said, well, let's just work with DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion policies. And, you know, and I know we agree on this, but the wording is everything. And people on the left really care about words. And yeah. I'm now where, like, you know what, this has got to go. But nature abhors a void. You don't just remove something and hope it's not going to be filled with something 10 times worse. And so my friends on the right are like, nope, just get rid of it, end of story. And maybe they live in a red state and that can happen, but
exactly.
that's not going to play everywhere.
Exactly. And I totally agree with you on that.
I always say that Republicans don't communicate well and Democrats don't hear well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it's just you're speaking different love languages. That's a bad recipe for things. We need two strong parties, not one super party and the other being decimated. And so I guess I'm middle of the road enough that I want like a stable situation.
I totally agree with you. And I want to tell you, like, you know, I was very moderate, but I just feel like I stayed the same. And the left went so far left that now if you draw the median point, I'm on the right
mm-hmm.
of it. So, and I want you to know, too, like, I've had fundraisers at my house for RFK. I had fundraiser for Richie Torres. You know, I will fundraise for anyone who's not insane. And I totally realize that certain districts will never go red. They'll stay blue, so I'd rather support the non-insane Democrat. So I'm with you on that.
It's the person. I've always been principled over people. It's just like, and I think some people, like, they have to imagine having a beer with the person. I mean, you're never going to have a beer with the person.
Yes.
So obsessed with that. I also think that every 4 years or 2 years or 6 years, it's a different job. You know, like, if you're running a business and you're hiring an assistant, your assistant in year one will be doing a very different job description than in year 10. You know?
I love that. That makes so much sense what you just said. So true.
Well, and it's like, and what do we need? It's like there's a bull market, a bear market, there's a wartime president, a peacetime. There's different things. I mean, it would be great if we could get all things to all people. But the first thing, as your profession says, is do no harm. And this DEI, it's really front and center. And Sheldon, boy, did he lay it out so well in the last episode, because he broke down in the field of medicine how, I mean, I think most people would say that medical communication in general has been going down for decades. That's, you know, no surprise. I think most people, you don't need a PhD to say that, but he broke that down really well too. But connecting the dots with how medicine moved away from centering the patient to not just centering money in the bottom line, but then centering the state like the Nazis did. But, you know, at this point, we're centering DEI. And if DEI is not really calibrated to, I mean, it sounds great. If it did what it did, it would be great, wouldn't it? But it doesn't. You've been listening to Talking Point on the Jewish TV channel. In the next segment of my interview with Dr. Sheila Nazarian, We'll explore the future of DEI policies in medical schools and how its approach may vary between blue states and red states under a Trump presidency, and why Sheila's own detail method might actually be an especially strong option for blue states in particular. Until then, subscribe to our mailing list, follow us on social media, and share us with your friends to help BIPOC News continue fighting anti-Semitism, Israelphobia, and miseducation. For Jewish TV Channel, I'm Laura Kessler. See you next time.